Welcome to Tom and Lorenzo's Pop Style Opinion Fest.
We're here to render judgment on the worlds of celebrity, pop culture, television, and fashion.
Strap yourselves in for some hardcore opinionating, darlings.
This is Tom and Lorenzo's Pop Style Opinion Fest.
We're Tom and Lorenzo.
And this is the Pop Style Opinion Fest. Hello, kittens. Welcome back to another edition of the PSO. I am the T in your T-Lo, Tom Fischel. I'm here with the Low in your T-Lo, Lorenzo Marquez, my lovely husband.
Hello.
How are you today, Lorenzo, my lovely
husband? Not tired, because we always say we're tired.
Yeah, we're not going to start off by complaining. No, we had a good week.
No, we had a great week. Thanks. Yeah,
good content week.
Things are moving really, really fast.
What's that?
Things are moving really, really fast, you know, like about everything.
You mean talking about the book?
The book and everything. We're starting to get more content for the site. It's just been a very busy week. But, I mean, especially the book.
Yes. If you weren't on our site this week, and shame, forever shame.
Shame on you.
We're going to stand behind you like the Game of Thrones nuns and ring our shame bell. But if you happen to not have caught our announcement this week, the cover for our book was released, and it's available for pre-order, and we're very excited because that cover, I got to tell you.
Oh, my God. It's beautiful.
I still tear up when I look at it. It's so gorgeous. It's so vibrant. It's so in the spirit of the book, I think. I think it captures the book incredibly well in the sense that it tries to tell an epic story, but also keep it light and fun in the manner of almost like a comic book. What are you saying?
It's a just gorgeous cover. The colors are great, and it's just a beautiful way of having all these important, amazing people all together and style like a comic book cover. It's just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
We love it very much, and the closer it becomes a reality, the book is being released on March 3rd. Which does sound like a really long time, and it does to me. I mean, every day I'm like, oh, how many more days? But it'll come quicker than not. And it's just, I don't know, it's real now. It went from concept to real. Like, here it is. It's real. It's got an entry on Amazon. Like,
right. When you see it on Amazon, you were like, all right, okay, it's real.
It's real. I have yet to hold a copy in my hands. That's the big moment.
I remember.
And we will cry all over social media when we do that. But please go check it out. And if you are at all interested in this book or in supporting us, again, it's Legendary Children, the First Decade of RuPaul's Drag Race in the Last Century of Queer Life. And if you want to know anything about the genesis of the book, what it's about, the tone of the book, you can go to our site, TomandLorenzo.com, click on the Legendary tag at the top of the page, and you will be treated to an array of content surrounding the book and its tone. And my point is, what I want to say is, I want to take this opportunity and this platform of a podcast and say to anybody listening, if you are thinking of supporting us in this endeavor, pre-ordering the book would be incredibly helpful. This sort of thing boosts your sales right out of the gate. Uh-huh. It boosts your first week sales. It puts you on lists, and those lists generate more marketing opportunities. And you know, it's all algorithm based when you're talking about things like Amazon and stuff like that. So the point now is to generate as much interest in the book and interest in sales of the book so that it comes out of the gate very, very strong. It's a highly competitive market out there, and you have to pull every trick out of your bag to keep your book in the mix. So if you love us, go to our site. It's pinned at the top of the page. It's, and it'll be there. Oh, honey, it'll be there all year. It's not going anywhere. all the order information, the cover and everything like that. And you can just go from there to, and it doesn't have to be Amazon. There are plenty of other sites you can order from.
Barnes & Noble and all the other places that you can order from.
In similar news, and then we will stop talking about the book, although it will come up later in our discussion about music. But in similar news, if you are a entertainment or LGBT or queer journalist, if you write for an LGBTQ outlet or an entertainment outlet and you would like a review copy of the book, please, please, please contact us at tilo@tomandlorenzo.com. Similarly, if you're an academic or you teach queer studies, media studies, anything around which this book might be helpful or interesting to your students, again, please drop us a line, tilo@tomandlorenzo.com. Tell us where you teach and what you teach, and we'll send you a review copy. Please do that soon, because I've already sent in 2 lists to our publisher, but I'd really like to round up as many people as I can.
Right, right.
And that's it. That's all we'll say about the book. We're very excited. We got 6 more months to talk about it, and we're going to drive you guys crazy. But this was a big, exciting day for to show people your cover is always like, oh,
I know. We've been waiting for so long to show that cover.
It's real.
To you guys.
It's not just words, and it's someone else's interpretation of your book. And I'm always, you know, Lorenzo and I are self-published. We've been self-published since day one. We do it all ourselves. But when you turn yourselves over to a publisher like that, there's all these wonderful experiences, one of which is, and I remember this was absolutely the same way I felt when the cover to our first book came out. I thought, wow, there were like meetings about this. There was like meetings about our work, and people had to decide what, like all of this stuff happens in other departments. And I guess that sounds weird that I'm focused on that. But again, we're solitary in our work. So it's always sort of this joyous little gift. It's like when edits come back on the book. I'm like, wow, someone's like tearing my work apart. But I love it. I love it because it takes all the pressure off me. All I have to worry about is producing good product. And everybody else will surround us with their best efforts at promoting it or whatever, or packaging it.
There are so many decisions that need to be made. And that's the thing. We had no idea that was such a long and detailed process to publish a book. I mean, I remember when we first published our first one, I was like, wow. So, you know, there's so many people involved, so much stuff going on. The marketing team, the editing team, and then you talk about the cover. Then you know it's a lot.
And the feel like this, the experience of the second book is totally different from the experience of the first book. Not least of which is because the first book was a general sort of essays on entertainment and celebrity with a humorous bent. It was a little unfocused, let's say, but this is an extremely focused book on an extremely focused topic toward an extremely focused demographic. So the experience is very different.
And researched.
That's the other thing, is that because it's a fact-based book, it's not just opinions, it's facts, it's history. Right. There was all this pressure, I mean, self-imposed pressure to get everything correct. And then it went through a fact-checking process through the publisher. And that was just a wonderful feeling to have certain things questioned. I had to strike certain things because I think they were true, but I didn't have enough documentation to back it up, that sort of thing. And I've never had my work submitted to that. And wonderful feeling. Truly wonderful, wonderful
feeling. It's a great feeling.
Yeah, because what happens at the end is like, wow, this is the freaking best possible version of my work. Our work. Our vision, our voice, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I said I would shut up, and then I spent another 5 minutes talking
about it. But anyway, the gist of it is, buy our book now.
Yeah, pre-order our book, please. Please, 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 please. It's not coming out until March. And hey, I mean, if now's not the time, we will not hold it against you.
No, absolutely. We understand.
Please consider buying it in 6 months or whatever. Kindle or paperback, we are not judgy about that sort of thing. And I know this all sounds very mercenary, and of course it is. We want our book to sell, of course, but I cannot tell you how much we love this book, and I cannot tell you how much we just can't wait to engage people with it, to talk to people about what we said in the book and who we discussed in the book and points that we made. So enough about that. I guess we should move on to other topics of the week. Although I think before that, no, we can start with that. Go ahead. Let's start with the Ryan Murphy thing.
Oh, yes. Okay. Anyway, Ryan Murphy, you know, Sausage Factory, Endless Sausage Factory type of ideas for shows. He has a ton more ideas, and apparently he has a ton more shows coming up. It's interesting because I read the article, and I was like, okay, more shows. You know, your first reaction was like, oh my God. He's
well,
just
let's,
like
let's establish the shows that he's doing.
So let's talk about the ones he's going to do.
It came out this week that he is doing an adaptation of A Chorus Line, and that he will also be doing a biography of Halston, which we actually did most of a podcast recently entirely devoted to Halston.
Because the movie came out.
Yeah, because the documentary came out, because we think he's a fascinating figure. And pardon me, he'll be doing the Halston bio with Ewan McGregor, which is just spectacular casting. I can't see that not working. But our original response to this news, and you take this with the news that he's developing like a series with Sarah Paulson playing Nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and he's doing Boys in the Band right now. And the man is just a freight train of Generation X white gay obsessions playing out in all of his work. And because we are Gen X white gays, I guess there's a part of us that it just... I get it. I get where he's coming from. He shares a lot of the same fascinations we do. I mean, he got to redo, you know, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane with Susan Sarandon and Jessica Lange, you know, that sort of thing. He's really getting to play with all the toys because he has all this power. And our first reaction, I have to say, was a little negative almost. We both were like, oh, Jesus, can he get away from all the gay stuff? Can he do anything but like this campy gay stuff? And I think we were wrong. Why don't I've set that up. Why don't you tell me your thoughts before we get into why I think we were wrong?
Like you said, we were wrong because these are topics that pretty much nobody's talking about. We don't see it on TV.
And why did you think it was wrong? What was your first? Why was your first reaction that, oh my God, why is he doing all this
stuff? Because he has a tendency, that's my opinion, to have great ideas, which all these are great ideas. We're going to talk about them all. But they don't get developed well enough to become a great show. Mm-hmm. That's my take. Most of them have great ideas. Most of them is a great idea. And then it gets developed. And in the beginning, first episode, second episode is fantastic. And we're like all over it. Right. And then it just falls apart. I think that there's too many ideas, too many shows coming out pretty much one right after the other.
Some of this may be colored by the fact that we have seen The Politician, which is his upcoming Netflix series.
I even forgot about that one.
And I think we're still embargoed, correct?
I don't remember.
But I mean, let's just say that we weren't joyous over it. We'll have more to say when it's closer to its release, but it didn't fill us with joy. And I think all of that remains true. First, that he has lots of ideas, but his follow-through isn't always great. And B, that he does focus narrowly on one very narrow perspective, which is white, gay, male, Gen X, you know, 50-year-old mm-hmm. white, gay, male obsessions, pop culture obsessions. He's doing something on Monica Lewinsky. He's doing something on Nurse Ratched. He's doing A Chorus Line. He's doing Halston. He's doing Boys in the Band.
And there's the horror one, the 1980...
He's been doing American Horror Story for a long time, right. And I don't even know how much of that is him anymore because he's moved over to Netflix. I mean, yes, he's doing... a take on, or American Horror Story is going to do a take on 1980s slasher movies. But I mean, I would expect that from that show. However, after we both sort of sneered at it and acted like bitter old queens at the news, we were reading other gay journalists and entertainment writers on social media, many of them younger than us, and they were thrilled at some of these announcements. And I realized that just through reading other people, and getting other perspectives, that I shouldn't be so cynical about the fact that there is all of this very campy gay content being given a lot of money in big budgets and major stars.
Right.
It's worth it to be excited about that stuff. I think one writer said, this is the kind of stuff I dreamed about as a little boy, but I knew was never going to be on TV.
You know?
I think it's supposed to be a 10... episode series on A Chorus Line. Like, he's doing it like a limited series. So, I mean, he's blowing up the gay and he's getting a lot of money to do it. And we should probably step back and not sound like we're bitter and jealous because he's getting to do all this stuff, which I'm not jealous because I don't want to be a TV producer.
I think they're fascinating topics and
Nurse Ratched, I'm not too sure about.
Yeah, but Halston and The Chorus Line and all these shows. I think they're interesting. You know, everybody remembers Chorus Line and the importance of it in a way.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see the younger generation watching that type of stuff. It was the same thing with Pose. You know,
he took Paris is Burning and turned it into a television series. And I mean, what am I supposed to criticize that? Pose is a major
right.
moment in transgender representation and queer television. And I have nothing bad to say about that as a concept or about the people who brought that to realities.
The thing about Pose...
I think the chorus line and Ratchet Things and the Monica Lewinsky thing were the three that I was like, okay, really? But go ahead, what were you going to say?
The thing about Pose that... what made me shut up about it, my criticism about it, is that on Twitter, all these young people, all these, like... LGBT community, very young folks on Twitter talking about it and how excited they were, and they didn't know about certain things that there are depicted on the show, that type of stuff.
Right.
So that's when I realized the importance of it is to have it and to keep repeating it so that you don't forget your history or you know, if you don't know about your history, that's a way to learn about it.
Right.
So my thing about Pose got, you know, I softened a little.
I think that tends to be our reaction to a lot of Ryan Murphy stuff, right. is we treat it very cynically, and then it sort of wins us over, and then it disappoints us in the end. But you know what doesn't disappoint? Postmates, which is sponsoring this portion of the podcast. When you need red wine at 4 p.m., sushi at 9 p.m., a breakfast burrito at 8 a.m., and ibuprofen at 10 a.m., well, you're having a hell of a day, but you can also Postmate it. Postmates is your personal food delivery, grocery delivery, whatever kind of delivery service all year round. Anything you're craving, Postmates can deliver. They're the largest on-demand network in the U.S. and offer delivery from all the restaurants, grocery, and convenience stores and traditional retailers you could possibly want or need. Can I tell you how much I love that? Because there are times when neither one of us can get out of the house to get anything done. And I think a lot of people are like that. 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, Postmates will bring you what you need within the hour. No more trips to the store. You don't even have to know where the store is. Postmates will deliver anything to you. So download the app for iOS or Android for free. Browse local restaurants and businesses and track your deliveries in real time. For a limited time, Postmates is giving our listeners $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days. To start your free deliveries, download the app and use code TLO. That's code TLO for $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days when you download the Postmates app. Anything you need, anytime you need it, Postmate it. Download Postmates and save with code TLO. Thank you, Postmates. So, yes, we were cynical, cranky elder queens at the news of Ryan Murphy's stuff. But honestly, I'm not feeling ratchet. A lot of Ryan Murphy stuff feels like a Saturday Night Live skit that they gave $100 million in 10 episodes to.
Oh my God, that is so...
That's the Nurse Ratched thing. Oh I'm like, God, okay, yes, Nurse yes. Ratched, you're going to do a 10-episode series
that's
on that?
Exactly. That's a great way to describe it.
Betty and Joan fighting, you're going to do 10, and it wasn't good. The feud didn't turn out to be all that good. It was too self-indulgent. It was... And that's the thing with Murphy. He plays with his dolls on camera. He plays with his dolls. And he forgets about characters. The reason Pose works so well is because Murphy's fingerprints are not all over it. He largely passed the creative aspect of the show over to transgender writers and producers, which was very smart. But when it's him, it's a lot of doll playing. It's the one thing I kind of fear about the Boys in the Band adaptation, which I know the Broadway adaptation, which he was responsible for, was highly lauded. But I can't help feeling like it's going to be him playing with all these gay actors in a dollhouse. That's the only way I know how to describe his style sometimes.
I think here my issues with Ryan Murphy's productions. First one, that I always feel that the script is not good enough. It's way too weak. It doesn't
the
have a lot of...
scripts have won Emmys. Not all of them, of course.
Well, of course. I mean, a lot of things. Gwyneth Paltrow has an Oscar.
That's his answer every time.
So it feels weak. It feels a little too, I don't know, too preachy sometimes. It just doesn't feel real, the way the people talk and so on. So I think if he improved that, that would be great. I also think that he's way too in love with certain actors, and he keeps using them over and over again, regardless if they fit that specific character or not.
I agree.
So he ends up using the same people, and they're not doing a good job. But he likes them, and he keeps working with them. He's fascinated with cute boys, because, you know, it's fine.
Again, I'm not really going to hold that against
him. So you see a lot of cute actors who can't act at all. doing a horrible job, but they're cute. So, you know, we're going to watch it because they're cute. They're hot. Or he gets amazing people like Jessica Lange, and he doesn't know what to do with them.
He just makes them play the same character.
Right.
Except this time do it with a German accent.
Or, right, you know. Right. So they become very much like a character. A real, you know.
Dolls. So, he plays with his dolls.
Right.
His dolls and his diva dolls.
So I think if he fixed all that, it would improve his shows tremendously. That's how I feel about them. Like I said, great idea. Costumes are amazing. The lighting and all that looks beautiful. But it doesn't have much substance, I think.
I am largely in agreement on that, but I am willing to step back and realize that he's taking every opportunity that's being thrown at him to do television the way he wished television could be as a little gay boy.
I agree.
And all of his obsessions are playing out. He's 53 or whatever years old. He can do whatever he wants. And this is what he's choosing to do. And I should not be such a bitch about it, because it is, when you step back, it's like, well, that's kind of fun and good for him. Like, he's queering it up in his own way, in his own voice. And he's not being apologetic about any of it. He will bring as much gayness to television as he can bring. Even if a lot of it, like, again, A Chorus Line and Nurse Ratched and Boys in the Band and even Pose, a lot of it is derivative of other stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And that's sometimes a hard thing to take with Murphy, is how much of his stuff is derivative. How much of Feud, Betty and Joan was just his opportunity to restage classic movies and reshoot them with Susan Sarandon and Jessica Lange. It was roughly 40% of that entire series.
And use some real facts, like behind the scenes kind of drama.
Right. It's six and one half dozen of the other. There's a lot of problems I have with his work from a critical perspective, from looking at the directing, from looking at the style, from the choices that are made. But I sometimes confuse that with a problem with his outlook or his obsessions, and actually taking a step back, I have no problem with his obsessions. If he's a middle-aged white gay man who wants to take millions of dollars to make award-winning series about his middle-aged white gay male obsessions, well, more power to you, honey.
I think in general, every director has an obsession, and they you know, or obsessions, and they become part of their movies or TV shows and everything. I mean, that's how they get inspired by something. It's whatever they're obsessed with.
Agreed. Now I'm going to turn the next topic over to you, since you saw much more of it than I did. But we wanted to talk a little bit about Styling Hollywood, which is the new show on Netflix. Let me pull up their names. About Jason Bolden and Adair Curtis. They are married business partners. Jason is a high-ranking celebrity stylist. Mm-hmm. He has a lot of A-list clients. Yes. And Adair is a interior designer, and they're based in Los Angeles, and they're both African-American, and they're a couple. So, personally, I was not primed to watch this series, because my days of... I just don't watch reality outside of RuPaul's Drag Race and Project Runway. I don't watch anything else, and I definitely don't watch shows that aren't competitive, like that are just about following people around in their jobs and in their lot. Like, this show is classic Bravo. It's not on Bravo, it's on Netflix, but it looks and is structured exactly like every Bravo reality TV, like the Real Housewives and Vanderpump Rules and all that. And I'm not primed to like that sort of thing. I did watch one episode. And the reason we watched one episode is because people were talking about the show and talking about the importance of seeing, first, a loving black gay male couple, and second, a highly successful and stylish black gay male couple get their own TV show. So that right there sets it apart from The Housewives. It sets it apart from the Rachel Zoe project and stuff like that. Again, because of who is in the center of the show. And that made me curious enough to watch it. Go.
I agree with all that, but I also think I'm, you know, I watch anything fashion on TV. I'm obsessed with fashion shows, and I don't think we have enough of them. So I was very excited, A, because, as you said, it was a gay couple, black gay couple, and they've been together for a long time. I was surprised because I didn't know.
You can tell.
And I love that. You can tell, exactly.
It's just like us.
The way they talk, I was like, oh my God, that sounds just like me and Tom. The way they bicker and the way they talk about things, and they don't even have to use words, that kind of stuff. You can tell that they've been a couple for a long time, which is great. So to see a black gay couple on TV is awesome. That alone is great.
I agree.
And the fact that we don't, also the fact that you have a show on TV showing you what happens on the red carpet. And most people still, if you read Tom Lorenzo, you know exactly what goes on. But a lot of people have no idea how the red carpet works.
Right. What a high pressure situation it actually is.
High pressure and everything. So it's nice to have a show about that. The show is not just about the red carpet. His husband has a interior design type of
So they do design business. Makeovers, right?
They also do design makeovers for celebrities. Which I mean,
that's a hook for a show. That's different.
Well, since they are a couple and they have a company together, it's called Something Studios. I forget the name. So they work together. It's the same building, same office. He does red carpet. He does, you know, interior designing. So it works. I'm personally not interested that much on the interior design part. That's just not my thing. But the fashion part, I'm fascinated by it. Love it. I absolutely love it.
I just want to jump in. He has major clients.
Right.
He has Taraji P. Henson, like all the people that we cover on our site. Yara Shahidi, Zazie Beetz, Gabrielle Union, right?
Right.
Like, mm-hmm. The first episode was called Black Girl Magic, and they must have said the phrase Black Girl Magic about 300 times in 40 minutes. But clearly they have an African-American female base
right,
of clients.
They do.
And some of the most stylish women on the red carpet. So credit to him. Go ahead.
I agree. I love the whole thing about picking dresses, choosing dresses, and you know, having the makeup people, the hairstylists, they all showing up and doing their job. We don't see enough of that. If you're interested in fashion, if you're interested on you know in the red carpet, you know, whole magic thing. I think it's phenomenal. You guys have noticed that we're starting to add at the bottom of our posts who does the hair and who does the makeup. So I was very excited to see some of those names on the show. I was like, oh yeah, there you are. So it's fun because, you know, hair and makeup is also important. And I feel like most places don't tell who the hair person and the makeup person, you know, who they are. They usually do just, sometimes they do the stylist, not always, but they, anyway, my point is that I was very, very excited, and I still remember so excited when Rachel Zoe had her show, because it was the first show ever on television like that. So I loved it. And then Brad Greskin had his short version. But again, all white people, all the main, you know, white stylists out there. So I was thrilled to see a show about a black stylist, very successful stylist, because we don't even hear about them. I mean, except for Law Roach is getting some recognition now because of Celine Dion and because of Zendaya. So yeah, he's kind of a little more popular, but we don't see that many out there.
I do think it should be pointed out when you talk about, like, It was about 10 years ago, the Rachel Zoe project. That had to have been about 10 years ago. And Brad Goreski's show was probably about 7 years ago. And as you said, all white at the time. We have been writing about the red carpet for over a decade now. And we have said this before, the red carpet has gotten blacker in that time. And by that, I mean high-ranking events now have more black people on the red carpet than 10 years ago. Big budget premieres, award shows. There was a concerted effort, of course, to and ongoing,
it's true.
Oscars so white and all that. It's been an ongoing topic of discussion that has only increased in the 10 years that we have been following this stuff. And the result is, we used to talk about this back in the day, 2009 or so, we made a commitment because readers were pointing out to us that we were too focused on white celebrities. So we made a commitment to start making sure that the front page of our site was diverse. And that was a thing that was difficult to do. We had to devote time to finding content because it was Kerry Washington and Michelle Obama, and that was it. And then Lupita Nyong'o came along, and then it started blowing up more and more and more. And then you have people like Zendaya and all the people I just mentioned, Taraji, Zazie Beetz, and all that. And Chadwick Boseman, the cast of Black Panther, all of that. But there's a very big difference between the red carpet of 2019 and the red carpet of 2009 in terms of its racial makeup. And not only are we seeing way more Black and African American stars wearing high fashion on the red carpet than we were 10 years ago, but there is an undercurrent of Black fashion Black red carpet fashion forming. Mm-hmm. There is like a world where people only work in that world. And Law Roach doesn't only work with Black people, but he is known for taking on Black women and like Jason Bolden is his clientele. So I'm glad to see this representation of how the red carpet has changed and who the players are right now, because a show like this would not have been made 10 years ago. A show like 10 years ago, it would have been Rachel Zoe and Brad Goreski. It would have only been white people working on white celebrities.
Right. Like I said, because I have to write at the bottom of every post who the hair person is and who the makeup person is, I know all these names, and I'm very excited to see all of them, because it's nice to see all these Black talent represented and showing up and doing hair and makeup, because they're, it's just beautiful. And as you said, because we see a lot of more African-American, I'd say, or Black people in general on the red carpet, because they're, we're having more movies about Black people or with Black people.
Right.
Big names. So they're also getting big.
There's more Black directors, right. That sort of thing.
They are getting better stuff. They're getting better clothes. Right. You see them wearing like big names now, when maybe 10 years ago, they could barely get any outfit from any designer. And now you have Taraji P. Henson, they show in the episode wearing Jean-Baptiste Valli.
Right.
This gorgeous, very beautiful dress. Anyway, so all that stuff is exciting. If you like fashion, if you like the red carpet, if you want to see how it works, the type of pressure that the stylists go through to finally have that person on the red carpet wearing whatever they picked for them, it's a great show. The only problem that I have with the show in terms of... Yes, go ahead.
See, I would not call it a great show. It has all that going for it in terms of representation. But right. And please take this with a grain of salt. I don't like this type of show, but it's very reality TV.
Well,
it's very stagey, very high drama.
Right.
Go
ahead. That's what I was about to say. It's a great show in the sense that if you like fashion, if you like the red carpet, it's a great show for that. However, I feel that the show is doing the same thing that every reality TV show does, manufacture drama. There's no need for all that drama that it's going to have a happy ending. They always create these situations like, oh my God, the dress is not going to be here. Oh my God, is she going to be here? Oh my God, is she going to like it? All these drama for nothing, when you could just focus on interesting things, the process, talk about the fabrics, talk about the dresses, talk about all that stuff. There's no need for the drama. And then it's very, very the same formula. The employees, the interns, they all behave the same way that you see on a reality TV show. They all have their own, the same issues. That part, I'm tired of,
You did enjoy. You said you watched several episodes, and you did.
I watched several episodes, and like I said, I like fashion shows. I love them on TV. TV shows. So I watch any one of them. I love them. I like to see the process, and it's interesting. We talked about this too, because you see the clothes on TV moving, and then it's a different feeling. It's a different reaction the episode with Taraji P. Henson is absolutely fun. It's very funny because she is funny. So she's trying on the dress and she makes all these jokes about it. It's hysterical. So it's that behind the scene that if you don't watch a show like that, you don't have the opportunity to see.
Fair enough. All right, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and, wade into the Lana Del Rey waters. Girlfriend opened her mouth last night and started a little scandal. Yes. We'll be right back.
Talking celebrities, pop culture, TV, and fashion. This is Tom and Lorenzo's Pop Style Opinion Fest.
We're back on the Opinion Fest, and because this is an Opinion Fest, we're going to wade into the waters of Lana Del Rey's latest outburst. Not that she's got a history of outbursts, but It happened yesterday, and as so many of these things do happen on social media, the critic for NPR, the music critic for NPR, Ann Powers, who is a longstanding critic of renown and highly regarded,
right,
wrote a very long piece, like over 3,000 words, talking about Lana Del Rey's latest album, Norman Fucking Rockwell, which is getting a lot of critical
reviews,
buzz.
Yeah.
Many are calling it her best work ever. It's doing very well. And this piece written by Ann Powers was by no measure a pan of the album. It was a long, somewhat intellectual, music critic heavy sort of piece about contextualizing that work, contextualizing Lana Del Rey's work up until this moment, contextualizing her persona and her image and how she's grown as an artist. Now, you can't write a piece like that without having a few mildly critical things to say about them. If you're saying that she's grown as an artist, then you have to say when, you know, point out when she was lacking as an artist, so to speak, or when she hadn't matured. You have to make these comparisons.
Right.
In addition, there were comparisons made to some very legendary figures, like Joni Mitchell, to whom she was compared, not unfavorably, but not quite at Joni Mitchell's level, who, okay, well, Joni Mitchell's a legend. So that's not really the worst thing in the world. She was also favorably compared to Lady Gaga. Like, it was not a dismissive piece, and it wasn't even, it was critical in the sense of art criticism, of how you approach art criticism, but it was not critical of her. Anyway, so this piece was posted, and Ann Powers linked to it on Twitter, said she was very proud of the piece, I think. Pardon me. And Lana responded in two tweets that got a lot of
attention.
First one was, here's a little side note on your piece. I don't even relate to one observation you made about the music. There's nothing uncooked about me. She was called like uncooked in comparison to Joni Mitchell. Like, she was not quite there yet. That's not the worst thing you can say. There's nothing uncooked about me. To write about me is nothing like it is to be with me. Never had a persona, never needed one, never will, because there was much talk of her persona. And next tweet. So don't call yourself a fan like you did in the article, and don't count your editor one either. I may never have made bold political or cultural statements before, because my gift is the warmth I live my life with and the self-reflection I share generously. Now, we're going to launch into her in a second, but I do want to state that I respect Lana Del Rey as an artist. I like a lot of her music, and I am not against the idea of an artist addressing criticism. Before we get to all of that, I would like to take a quick moment to talk about Joybird, which is sponsoring this
portion about joy.
Of the podcast. Yes, let's talk about joy before we start yelling at singers. So Joybird empowers you to create the furniture and space that brings you joy and keeps those summer vibes flowing all year long. They've released their summer lookbook featuring items like the Soto outdoor chair, the Liam leather sofa, and the Jules brass planter. With Joybird, you get one-of-a-kind furniture crafted to your unique taste. Turn your ideas into reality with hundreds of styles and options. Want a sofa in aquatic blue or indigo? Love seat in the hottest red and inviting coral or even bubblegum pink? If you can dream it, Joybird can make it a reality. From rich buttery leather to the plushest velvet you've ever felt, find the fabric and texture that's right for you. Joybird offers a range of kid and pet-friendly upholstery options so that your creations can stand the test of time, and there are free personal design consultants to help nail down your perfect design. It's quality handcrafted furniture. Each Joybird piece is made by hand with care and precision, using high-quality hardwood and responsibly sourced materials to fit your exact specifications. And there's a limited lifetime warranty included, plus a 365-day home trial. Skip the furniture store and bring the showroom home. Sit on it, sleep on it, and break it in. If you don't love your Joybird, return it. There's hassle-free in-home delivery. They'll even remove all the packing materials and free returns within 2 weeks of delivery. So, see how Joybird can help you design your dream space. I can't say Joybird. Help you design your dream spurs Make furniture your own at joybird.com/Lorenzo. Create the furniture that brings you joy today at joybird.com/Lorenzo, because Lorenzo brings me joy.
Yes.
Always. Go to joybird.com/Lorenzo and receive an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order by using the code Lorenzo. That's joybird.com/Lorenzo for 25% off your first order by using the code Lorenzo. Thank you, Joybird. That's joybird.com/Lorenzo. Having so much trouble with that one today. Joybird. Okay, so Lana Del Rey, look, you're free to address criticisms. You're free to address pieces. It's not advised, because it never comes out well when you do. And aside from the fact that she has these crazy stans that have been going after Ann Powers for the last 12 hours, have driven her off Twitter, are calling her ugly and fat and old and end your career now, bitch, and that sort of thing. And Lana Del Rey's not silly. She's not stupid. She's not naive. She knew posting this on social media.
Oh, yeah.
She knew that would happen. And hours have gone by of this woman being harassed for writing a very complimentary, nuanced, somewhat intellectual article about Lana Del Rey's career. And Lana Del Rey sicked her fan base on her and has not said a word to calm them down or to call them out and say, listen, guys, don't go calling her old or fat or ugly. There's no way Lana Del Rey doesn't know this is happening. She's being tagged on all of these responses. And that, I'll get into why I think she's wrong as an artist based on some of the stuff that she said. But that, I'm like, lady, if you don't come out soon and say something, I will have no respect left for you. Because right. That is just a shitty ass thing to do.
It's very interesting how things have changed. I mean, in the past, if you remember, without the internet, without social media, reviews were in the magazine, in the paper, you know, and you read it at home.
Right.
And you didn't have anyone to share that with, unless you talk to your friends about it or, you know, your colleagues at work and so on. But you didn't have social media to go and start yelling immediately.
Right.
So that has changed tremendously the way people come, the way people communicate. And also gives, I think the bad thing about social media is that it multiply that whole thing about artists being surrounded by yes people. Like, it's no longer right. just the 40 people around them. It's millions of people around them now because of social media telling them how wonderful they are. So that just brought the thing to a whole new level of that delusion that you never have anyone criticizing you or mildly criticizing you. And then you just can't take it. And then you go to social media and then you yell at the person who had some opinion that you didn't agree with, and then all your fans come after that person. We've had that happening to us, and I don't want to repeat the story again, but we had that happening to us. And they looked at our pictures. They called us ugly. They called us old. I mean, you name it. So I know, and I'm not Lana Del Rey or the or an NPR, you know, professional music critic. So it's happening too often. It happened with Lizzo, and I kind of understand Lizzo a little more, or at least I've sort of saw where that was coming from, because Lizzo, although she had a career before she became famous, before she became a star, but she didn't have that experience of a star when she criticized that piece. But Lana Del Rey has been, you know, she's been around for a while. So I would expect a little better from her. She's an amazing artist. I think I love her music. I love her talent. Talking about Norma fucking Rockwell, it's a great album with all these amazing references. She always has this very Americana type of approach, and it's just beautiful. Her art is beautiful. I do have to say, and my God, the comment section is going, I hope they don't come after me. I do think that her music is a little repetitive. The lyrics are different, but the way she sings, the way everything, the harmony and the way the music itself, it's a little repetitive. It's the same thing album after album. It's a little bit like Bjork. I absolutely worship Bjork, but if you pay close attention to her music, aside from a few pieces, everything kind of sounds the same. That, to me, is kind of the way Lana Del Rey sounds. And because I rushed to listen to this album, and it felt like, you know, all right, it's her again. That's how I say it. It's her again. I'm not saying it's not great. It's great. It's very creative, and she has the most beautiful voice. It's this velvety, just incredible voice. I love her voice. Love the way she sings. Anyway, so she is a great artist. She has established herself as a great artist. I don't understand why these people feel the need to go after some sort of criticism on. Of any sort. It just feels bad. It feels immature, insecure. No matter what you have to say, it's never going to look good for you.
I just want to address some of the things that she did say. Like I said, I feel like she can address her critics. That's fine. I don't think it ever looks good, but that's fine. I think the manner in which she addressed her was a little inflammatory, and I think the fact that her fan base is so over the top in the way they're attacking the woman is leaving Lana looking pretty bad by not saying anything more. But she's within her rights to say something. What she did say, however, I'll start with the first one. I don't even relate to one observation you made about the music. Here's the thing. And some artists, even high-ranking ones like Lana Del Rey, really don't understand this. But a critical piece is not written for the artist.
Right.
It's not for you. It's about you, but it's not for you. It doesn't matter if you saw anything in it that you felt was... Because you didn't write it. It was someone else interpreting your work as an artist. So to come out with this, I don't relate to one observation you made. Well... Good for you, but that piece was not for you. And this is a common problem that people who hate cultural criticism don't understand about it. It's not for the artist. It's not an attempt by the critic to improve the artist or to teach the artist as to what they did wrong. It's addressing the work. It's wrestling with the work and bringing your own feelings, your own references, your own knowledge to that in mm-hmm. order to contextualize it. So... Right, I lost a lot of respect right off the bat. I was like, wow, she clearly doesn't even know what cultural criticism actually is. It's not about cracking the code inside the artist's head, and it's certainly not about making the artist feel related to what you're saying.
Right.
It's about the critic interpreting the work. And she even said, to write about me is nothing like it is to be with me. Again, that is not the point of cultural criticism. It is not attempting to replicate what it's like to be with you. That's so egotistical and self-absorbed. It's really, I like her as an artist, but it really sort of is evidence of someone who cannot separate her personality from her art and thinks that when someone critiques her art, they're critiquing her personality. Like, no offense, but grow up, lady. Grow up.
Yeah, there are pieces out there like the Madonna one that, you know, Madonna criticized a lot. That the
people do go over the line. That
reporter,
absolutely.
And that the reporter actually spent a lot of time with her, and it was more about Madonna as an artist than a specific artwork. So I understand if you feel a little frustrated that you spend all that time with me,
right.
And then, you know, you focus on my age.
Or like Troy Sivan, who came out this week about
that
interview that he did, where the interviewer asked him about his bottoming preferences.
Oh, my God.
Now, look, he wrote a song that alluded to having sex and alluded to being a bottom. But that, honestly... He was criticized because he felt that question was out of line, and he said so. And then a bunch of people criticized him by saying, well, you wrote a song about sex. Well, Prince wrote a song about sex, too, but nobody asked him about blowjob. You know what I mean? Like, you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed... Again, this goes down to the same question of, as a journalist, you're not supposed to confuse the artist with the person.
And if you want to ask... I'm sorry. If you want to ask a question about the song, why did you write a song about bottoming? That's different than asking, are you a top or a bottom?
Right.
Because that was the question.
Right.
That's completely different.
It is out of line. It is off base. And a lot of people, some gay writers were like, well, he's bottom shaming. Like he's acting like it's such
God.
A... No, it has nothing to do with whether being a bottom is a shameful position. It's not... You wouldn't ask any artist, male or female, heterosexual, you would not ask them such descriptive questions about their sex practices. It was out of line, and he was right to say so. So that I'm just throwing that out as an example of it's fine for an artist to call out a journalist if they feel like they've... But this was not the piece. This was an NPR piece by a very well-respected music critic. And I want to briefly say, I said this to Lorenzo before we started, that I was going to work the book into this part of the discussion. But just real briefly, the hardest chapter, the most intimidating chapter in the book for to write was the chapter on music. Because it is the one art form that I have almost no experience writing about. I've written about film and television and fashion. Right. I've written about photography and books and, you know, whatever. But I don't write about music. I don't even like to talk about music because, and it wasn't until the critic Emily Nussbaum on Twitter made this point, because she's a member of Generation X, and she pointed out that one of the worst things about our generation is the way we attacked each other over our musical preferences and the way we claim that it said who you were and who you were not based on what music you listened to. She said it was one of the worst legacies of Gen X. And I remember talking to her about it on Twitter, and I was like, oh my God, you just explained to me why I never like to give my opinion on music.
Oh yeah.
My point being, music critics, I have always had the highest respect for really well-established, very good music critics because I'm in awe of what they can do. They are... All cultural critics talk about, have a set of critical faculties that they bring to their work. But a music critic, they have to have a knowledge base that is so expansive about the history of musical forms and such. They have to have a knowledge base about the technique of music.
Right. And it's a very specific...
Just one last thing, and then I'll pass it back to you. They do something that not even book critics not literary critics or film critics or fine art critics do. They contextualize that which has no form. Like music, there is no physical aspect of music. It's all so interpretive. So in order to conceptualize that and write 3,000 words on an album, relating it to people like Johnny Mitchell and Lady Gaga and pulling in all these references, that's a form of brilliance. Go ahead.
Yes, and also with music, you have very specific genres that you specialize in. I mean, if an opera review, someone who review operas, for example, or classical music, it's not the same person who's going to review Madonna's or Lady Gaga's latest album. It's a different set of skills. I play the violin and the harpsichord, and I know a lot about classical music, but I would never be able to write a review about Lana Del Rey's new album or Madonna or Lady Gaga or anybody like that, because it's just not my thing. I haven't done enough of that or have enough experience on that specific topic or type of music to do it. So. Again, music, it's even more specific, I think, than TV critic.
Anybody who can do it well has my utmost respect. And it was a beautiful piece by Ann Powers. And I just, the idea of Lana Del Rey getting bent out of shape over this is ridiculous. Second thing I wanted to address is in her second tweet, she said, because Ann Powers called herself a fan, and I think if you had... if you read it with a little nuance, you could see that that was very true. She spoke of her with great love and affection. Mm-hmm. If you're diving that deep into someone's work, you are a fan of their work. Right. You can't do it if you hate it. And it's just, it's distressing to hear an artist of this level not understand that at all. So she said, don't call yourself a fan like you did in the article, and don't call your editor one either. Fans are able to critique work and contextualize work. Is she really at this level? She's like her fifth album. She's been around for like 10 years. Does she really think that a fan is someone who loves her unreservedly and never has a bad thing or a critical or a nuanced thing? How protected can you possibly be from the real world?
I think, again, it has to do with the fact that we are so exposed to people that we don't know talking about the same things on the internet.
Right.
I mean, it was different, many years ago, you talk about a movie or a music, a song, or a TV show that you liked with your friends. And, these people are your friends. So in a way that you relate to them. But when you go on the internet and you start talking about a movie you like or dislike, and then, you get someone from the other side of the country that you don't even know who that person is yelling at you. So there's all this communication now with strangers, and people just get bent out of shape when you don't like the same things they do. And I find that horrifying and fascinating at the same time how social media has increased that,
right.
That people just cannot take criticism. They just cannot take the fact that they can't just calm down about someone not liking the same things you do.
Right.
That is so absurd to me.
Yeah, it is that much worse when it's a high-level artist attacking a high-level critic. This was not some troll.
Right.
Okay, and this was not some slam piece, some hit piece on your artwork. It is someone from a, I mean, we're talking NPR here. We're not talking TMZ, right?
Right.
We're not talking like, you know, I don't know, whatever the, I don't, whatever. I just find it so kind of upsetting that an artist at that level is that sheltered in her thinking and that unsophisticated in her understanding of what cultural criticism is.
Like, right.
I've listened to your lyrics. You're not, I mean, you're an artist. You're a nuanced thinker. You're, a grown woman.
They're great lyrics.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So how can you be this far off base
right.
about what you just read? And how can you let your fan base, I mean, more than anything else, we can disagree on whether or not she had a right to be upset by this piece, but sicking your fan base is an absolute no.
Right.
And pop stars, their fan bases are 1,000 times worse than, say, actors. Sort of like that Olivia Munn thing that happened a couple months ago where she blew up. But her fans did not go after... I mean, they did, but not in the way that pop fans go after any blasphemer.
What you do is you just give it to your fans and then let your fans do the dirty work.
Yeah, right.
You just stand there and watch your fans go after someone and kill them and harass them for days sometimes.
Right.
And it's just not right. It's not right. And but I think that now that, again, you have Twitter and Instagram and you have all these artists in control of their accounts, you know, they don't have to call a publicist or a PR person
right.
to say, is it okay if I say this? No, they grab their phone and they start yelling
at
people.
They start yelling.
And then, you know, the next day, they have all their people yelling at them and telling them to apologize.
We'll see what happens. I just checked Lana's account and she has not updated or anything
right.
like that. She's still letting her fans yell at this poor woman.
Because in a way, it's great for her. She's going to sell more, you know, more albums. She's gonna it, and it's out there. Everyone is talking about it. That's exactly what she quote unquote needs right now. You know, that's the type of exposure.
All right. One thing I wanted to say is we didn't mention this at the top of the show. Is we're going to DragCon tomorrow.
Oh yes. Very excited about it. Can't wait to see the
queens. We're just going to wander the floor of DragCon and take in the sights tomorrow in New York. So if you see us, say hello.
Say hi, please do.
We're the two big bearded daddies.
Yes.
And
I'm not a daddy, but anyway.
Oh, honey, you're a daddy. You're a daddy.
I'm nobody's daddy. Anyway.
I was 30 the first time a gay called
I know,
me a daddy.
And, no, not a daddy.
Yeah, you are.
Anyway.
Please sound off in the comments. Is Lorenzo a daddy?
Oh, God, no. Come on, no.
So we'll be at DragCon tomorrow. So if you're wandering the floors and see us, please say hello. And thank you, everyone, once again for listening to our cartoon voices. And if you would like to pre-order our book, we would
love you forever
for doing so. It is now available. You can go to our front page of TomLorenzo.com for all the information on that. Okay. Love you all. Bye-bye.
Bye.